Thanks, everybody, have a seat. So I want to welcome all the students who are here with us today. We appreciate you coming down to listen to our arguments, particularly on a day like today. We have folks from East High School and Grandview, is that right? Yes? Well, good enough.
Are we playing basketball?
We're very happy you're with us. So now we're going to hear a case that's called People versus Davis. May I have the entry of appearances, please, Mr. Holman?
I'm Matt Holman, District 176, for the people.
Very good, counsel.
Lynn Desner, District 39209, for the responding prosecutor, Mr. Davis.
All right, thank you. This case is up for an hour, so each side has a half an hour. Mr. Holman, please keep track of it. Whenever you're ready, sir, let me start.
May it please the court, before I start, I just wanted to mention that Ms. Nesner was nice enough to contact me yesterday and talk about how we should juggle our arguments because we have petitions and cross-petitions. And what we ultimately agreed on, which I hopefully assigned with you, is we're just going to follow the regular procedure. I'll go first. If I save any time, I will use it for rebuttal. However, we both agree that if the court wants to hear any sir rebuttal, we would be able to have that.
That's great. You have 3 minutes aside.
I was just saying, I've never had a court want to hear me talk more, so I think that's probably not going to happen for me.
And we're so eager. Would you kind of like raise the podium just a little bit so we can hear you a little bit better?
Sorry.
It's over there on the right hand. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Is that better there?
All right.
I'll try to speak up. As we all know from the previous case, the issue that this court took, there are three in this case, but one of the issues is whether this court should adopt a standard for self-representation competence under Indiana versus Edwards. And in my case, the answer to that question is no. And the reason is that despite what the Court of Appeals held here, the trial court didn't rule on the question of whether the defendant was competent to represent himself. Instead, it ruled on the separate issue under Godinez, which is whether the defendant voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently waived his right to counsel. Those are separate questions. Godinez and Edwards both recognized the distinction. In Godinez, they said the competence to waive the right to counsel is the competence to waive that right, not the competence to represent oneself. And then when we get to Edwards, Edwards says, Godinez does not answer the question that is now before us in Edwards. They are distinct questions. They seem that they have related components about competency and perhaps knowing voluntary intelligence to waive the right to counsel and proceed through self-representation, but they are distinct questions. And so, I don't think this case provides a proper vehicle for this court to determine whether an Edwards type standard should be adopted in Colorado, because that's not the issue that was before the trial court. However, it provides a great opportunity for this court to clarify the test under Godinez, both in its own right and in relation to Colorado laws such as Arguello and other standards bearing on the right to self-representation. And this is a great moment for me to stop and make a pitch to try to convince you that the tests that we have in place are adequate to protect defendants who wish to represent themselves. And I've written a quick list. We know we have the Faretta right to self-representation, but Faretta also recognizes that you can require a defendant to proceed with counsel where the defendant engages in serious obstructionist conduct that interferes with the trial court proceedings. Now, Dusky requires competency to stand trial before we even get to the question of whether someone's going to represent themselves. Godinez also provides a test that includes Dusky to determine competency to waive the right to counsel and also requires a knowing voluntary intelligent waiver of counsel. And our own case of Arguello provides a 14-part test, as Justice Hood mentioned. If it's robustly applied, it serves to also ensure that the defendant is making a proper waiver of counsel And this court said in Arguello that one of the factors in that consideration is if the defendant has some sort of mental condition issue, that the court consider that in making its determination. So I think the test that we have adequately protect defendants. Another way of looking at it is a defendant has to meet Dusky, he has to meet Godinez, he has to not be obstructing the trial, he has to make a knowing voluntary waiver of counsel, he has to meet the test under Arguello, and yet somehow he's going to be in a gray area that he's cleared all of those hurdles and he's not going to be able to confidently represent himself. I think Edwards, I don't want to discount it, but I think it creates a hypothetical idea of a gray area. But I think the test that we have adequately protects a defendant who has some mental health issues. Also, I want to mention that the Indiana versus Edwards is very unusual because it doesn't say that any test is constitutionally required in order for a defendant to represent himself. It only says that states may adopt a standard and apply it, and it won't offend the Constitution. So I wanted to mention in relation to Justice Hobbs' question about due process, the Supreme Court did not say that there's any, that it won't be constitutionally fair. They simply said, it's a very nuanced case, but I ultimately think all this was, if states wish to adopt such a test, and it's correct, whatever that's going to be, it's not going to offend the United States Constitution.
Can I ask you a question right there?
Sure.
I apologize a little bit. I don't mean to get two guys' cases mixed up, but I sort of beat up on the other counsel a little bit for answering what I think was your question. So let me ask
you
their question. Their question, because the two are clearly related.
Yeah.
Indiana v. Edwards does seem to create this gray area or allow discretion if we want to do it. But I guess the flip side of that is, how can it do that without having implicitly created a higher standard that has to be applied? And I think that was their half of the question, really, what the defense was arguing there. That is, if the defendant is allowed to represent himself, should the court have to decide that there is some standard beyond simply an effective waiver of his right to counsel in order to be able to do that?
Well, one is, let me go to the first part of your question, which is, Indiana versus Edwards is unusual, but I think it was careful not to create a heightened standard. I think it identified a concern that it thought states may wish to address but need not address, and it's not constitutionally required, which is the theoretical gray area defendant who falls in this gap between competence to waive counsel and make a knowing and voluntary waiver, and competence to represent themselves. So it's a peculiar thing. But the court didn't go so far, and they seemed careful. So obviously they did not essentially say that some sort of standard existed or was required, really, that it would not offend the Constitution. I think they recognize their mental illness is a complex question. Now, I'm sure I'm not answering the same question as I'm
not. No, you haven't, and that's what I'm getting at. Let me just do one follow-up on it, and that is, if Ferretta stands for the proposition that you have basically an equal and opposite right to your right to counsel, which is your right not to have counsel, and if you've met the standard of waiving your right to counsel, where is the daylight here that allows a judge some discretion to deny you your right? Your right to go pro se.
Right. I will tell you what Edwards identifies, and maybe, and I'm not sure where, I think there is a, well, that goes with a warning that it is dangerous and risky to trample on Ferretta without being sure how we're doing it, because it seems that the court has created this unusual opportunity. It says Indiana versus Edwards definitely says you must suffer from a severe mental illness, and there must be a nexus between your mental illness and your inability to carry out the basic tasks of a trial. Edwards talks about mental illness causing disorganized thinking or attention problems and some other things that are very, I would call very basic concepts, inabilities to function in the trial court. I don't think they've magically added all the subcommentator and commentators disagree now that we look at whether you have the trial skills, but it's a much more basic disorganized thinking that allows that. My position is that the test that we have, and when applied in my case in particular, address any kind of concern at that level.
Yeah, so what is that test?
Oh, the one in my case, which is the Godinez test, which is, and Godinez plus Arguello, which is that a defendant must be competent to stand trial under Dusky or Wade counsel because we use the same standard. And that's whether the defendant has sufficient present ability to consult with his lawyer with a reasonable degree of rational understanding, and whether he has a rational as well as factual understanding of the proceedings against him. And but you're gonna, this is a nice place to mention, I was reading Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Godinez, and I think it shows that the test in under Dusky is I keep using the word more robust, which is what Justice Hood mentioned earlier, and obviously I've thought of it before, so I'm not just stealing it from you, but the test is richer than maybe we think, and also, I think, than maybe the trial court of appeals in this case. What Justice Kennedy said was, although the Dusky standard refers to ability to consult with a lawyer, the crucial component of the inquiry is the defendant's possession of a reasonable degree of rational understanding. In other words, the focus of the Dusky formulation is on a particular level of mental functionings, which the ability to consult counsel helps identify. The possibility that the consultation will occur is not required for the standard to serve its purpose. In other words, although Edwards seems to imply that the Dusky standard is purely related to whether you can work with counsel, Kennedy points out in Godinez that actually it really goes for a reasonable degree of rational understanding. Can you carry out the basic functions of competency? And so I think that test, plus the known involuntary intelligence test, plus our Arguello embellishment on that, adequately encompass this defendant. So I think that's a long way around, and it may be a dodge to your question, but I don't think we need that. There's not a gap in our law that requires an additional test.
Well,
there is still a lot of gray, even after someone, say, navigates all of what you described, and the court says, all right, I find that you have knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily waived your right to counsel. At the end of the day, someone could still be thoroughly incompetent to represent themselves, and there are times as a trial judge when you feel like you're complicit in kind of a charade or a farce, to the point where I've even had a juror trial judge send out a question asking, why are you allowing this to happen? Sure. This is ridiculous. Mm. And so it undermines, one of the concerns, of course, is that it undermines the public's confidence in the system. So can you address that larger concern? I realize that
sure.
We get down to a doctrinal level that encompasses a lot, but can you just try to address that?
I will try, yes. Yeah. I think the first thing I thought of when you started making your question was, what are we talking about in the competency to represent yourself? And I know we've all read transcripts, and some of you have been trial judges and been there with pro se litigants who don't understand the rules, which are complicated and technical, and may go off on tangents, and as Ms. Van Horn mentioned, they make what seemingly irrational defense arguments on their behalf. But I don't think that ability is what Edwards is addressing, and I think to expand it to encompass poor self-representation would be to trample on Ferretta. So I think one is it's addressing a very limited group of people who are simply so, their executive functions are so poor that they can't have disorganized thought, and they can't have an attention span to addressed what's going on in the courtroom. And I think my case demonstrates that, those concerns are addressed by the Godinez test plus Arguello. And I think, well, I can't remember the second part of that. So there you know, I have an attention problem myself. But I think the test is sufficient to address those, the concern that Edwards is talking about, which is a very narrow, very dysfunctional group. And again, I just can't envision that you can clear all the hurdles of all these other standards for competency and self-representation and knowing intelligent waivers of all these things, and yet be so dysfunctional that you're disorganizing your thought and your inability to communicate that you clearly need. And again, Mr. Davis, in this case, did not clear that test, and I think that demonstrates, again, the...
Well, I think that's kind of helpful. You've tried to go at it straightforwardly, I think, but there is an additional competency for this particular group, if you can identify who they are, or have the instinct as a trial judge that they're in it, and that there's some kind of, you know, examination, a mental examination that gets you there, right? I mean...
Well, I mean,
so why isn't that an additional step?
Well, I think,
for this narrow group of people.
Sure. Well, and of course, I'm talking in circles. My position is that the tests we have adequately cover that, and I think Judge Hoffman's analysis here and his care in doing so demonstrates that a defendant who's not able to do those things.
Well, I'm just not sure that the trial judge is absent a little bit of further analysis on this. We'll come to that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I'm just not sure that the trial judges will tumble to that being a criteria.
Being part of the criteria? I just think the tests we have adequately protect defendants who have various mental health issues. So I'm not suggesting we add it. I think there's a mental condition concern that is already encompassed and addressed in the cases we have. And then this goes maybe to a more fundamental question about whether what's going to, how will this court decide that a test is necessary? Is it under some supervisory power, which is rarely used and only in exceptional circumstances where there's a need? Is there a due process concern that's apparent in these cases that mandates, in order for a fair trial in any of these cases, for the court to adopt one? I'm just not seeing that these cases prove that. I was looking up the proof is in the pudding, which I'm still not quite sure what that means, but these cases don't demonstrate.
Does it taste right?
Yeah. Then I would throw that and I'll try to get that. But it's these cases don't demonstrate to me, and I think before the court leaps into making that decision, I think we're certainly the parameters of Indiana versus Edwards, but I don't think these cases demonstrate a need for such a test.
Yes, one question that I have is thinking about the posture of Indiana versus Edwards and the way that the opinion was crafted, it seemed to be setting up a boundary to where a trial judge has those concerns. This is the boundary at which he can sort of force counsel upon a pro se defendant under these narrow circumstances and to do so without violating Pareto. And so I guess one question I have is, can we conceive of Indiana versus Edwards as really an opinion that applies only in kind of a dated situation where the trial court has basically imposed counsel against the defendant's will, forced the defendant to proceed with counsel, such that when we're looking back at that decision, we can say, did the trial court properly exercise its discretion under the liberal standard? As opposed to sort of a, hey, as I'm making this Arguello decision, I have to also make sure that the defendant meets this additional hurdle. Do you understand the distinction?
I'll start somewhere and we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
One is, I think initially a point that I thought you were making was that Indiana versus Edwards would only be triggered in a situation where the court is going to preclude self-representation and require counsel, and I think that's correct. In the other cases here where the defendants proceed through self-representation, I don't think it operates to mandate a determination. I think what Indiana versus Edwards says is it's all constitution even if you don't do it. Now, I'm not sure where we're going after that, but...
Well, I think that's what I was getting at. In other words, that Indiana versus Edwards really only applies to the situation where the trial court has, in fact, forced counsel on a defendant and not the opposite. So we think about Indiana only in that context and not in the context where the defendant otherwise made a valid waiver and was allowed to proceed for the sentence.
Right. I think that's correct. And you mentioned in the case such as the one we have here, Davis, earlier, and I want to go back to that because it's not necessary in Davis. And I think one of the interesting things about this juxtaposition is Godinez is a constitutionally required test. And the court found that it wasn't satisfied. And so it's unnecessary to reach for not constitutionally required tests under Indiana versus Edwards to see if that's right for additional reasons, because I think the issue stands or falls on whether the trial court made the proper ruling. And I think one of the things that's interesting about all of these competency sort of questions is they all involve similar things. Is there a severe mental illness, and how is it impacting the defendant's ability to make decisions or function or work with counsel or waive the right to counsel or plead guilty? And so the considerations are related, but they are distinct. And I think the test here ultimately was correctly applied by the trial judge here. And there's no need here to go to the next test. And I don't think the case are, I'm sorry, Judge.
You finished your thought, and
I'll keep rambling. So please go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, and I guess maybe this is what Justice Coates is getting at. What gave Judge Hoffman the discretion to do what he did after this defendant went for a copy valve? There was no diagnosis of a severe mental illness, and he went through the Arguello advisement in a way that was more lucid than many will see, right? And ultimately, Judge Hoffman just decides, despite all that, this really just seems like a bad idea because of some of the behavior you've exhibited in the courtroom on multiple occasions. So where this is back to his question, I think, about the daylight that allows a trial judge to make that assessment even after having gone through those other steps that are it comport with Dusky and what? Okay.
All right. I think I get it. Yes. Well, first of all, you don't get to the, we'll call it the Arguello question, the known voluntary intelligent question, unless you've met Dusky, because the way the law operates, of course, is that if you're not competent to stand trial, we don't proceed with the trial. You would probably most likely go to the state mental hospital until you're restored to competency. So there's no requirement, in order to do what Judge Hoffman did here, there's no requirement plainly under Godinez that would be contrary to Godinez, that he would somehow be barred from finding that the waiver was not knowing, voluntary, intelligent. What Judge Hoffman did in the second prong, which is the knowing, voluntary, intelligent prong, was entirely proper, and the reason is that the court's job, as it says in Godinez, under the first test, is an ability to participate in the proceedings, essentially, for the Dusky standard. For the second prong, it's do you, in fact, understand the right you're waiving? Is it a knowing and intelligent? As a matter of fact, now, whether you are in fact, able to do that is informed by, perhaps, by your mental condition. And what Judge Hoffman did here, and I don't mean this gratuitously, I think very thoroughly did, was try to consider what the defendant's motivations were for his, why he waived his right to counsel, his appreciation of the dangers and risks, which is what we require before there's a valid waiver, of going pro se, given his inability to communicate, his rather bizarre behavior where he threatened his attorneys with violence, and these were experienced public defenders who took this very seriously, so it wasn't some vital threat. He threatened an evaluator at some point, when he said, if I'm uncomfortable, I want to punch somebody and I don't want to punch you. He himself reported that he was bipolar, that he was depressed, and that he had paranoia. The paranoia made him not trust his attorneys, he said, because his medication wasn't treating it at one point. And so even though his ARBOA advisor man stays up here to fit all of the requirements, the court was there to assess the motivations behind that and whether it accurately reflected on your understanding. What the court said is, I think his mental condition is driving, I find that his mental condition is driving these decisions, and it's not a knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver of counsel. And the Godinez test provides for this. It's not, the waiver of counsel is not something idle. It's a threshold that must be met before you can proceed through self-representation. So I think everything Judge Hoffman did here was correct. And I know that there's some debate about, is he talking about capacity or the fact that he mentioned.
So what is that generally? He's protecting the safety of the courtroom and the dignity of the proceedings. He has some discretion in this circumstance.
I think there is some of that. He doesn't really talk about that, but there's definitely that concern, I think, that's there about will and obstruct the proceedings in some way, especially both the combination of his inability, the defense inability to communicate, and his occasionally violent threats toward others when he's in a we'll call it a distress situation, that for most people might make them upset.
So in this case, it's fairly convicted, no due process.
I don't think there is one, Your Honor. I think the court applied the proper test and properly required representation by counsel. And then I guess I don't know if I'll ever get to my other two issues, but I want to say one more thing about whether this court should adopt a test, which is, it's not clear how we would implement a test from a practical point of view, because for dusky competency, we have a statute that says we send you to the state hospital, your rights to some degree are waived as far as your confidentiality and Fifth Amendment rights are waived. We have a procedure to do that. We can put you there, we can bring you back. We don't have anything like that. And in a case like mine, and there are, I think maybe the others are like this too, there may be some initial dusky inquiries and competency violations. But then we get to a point later where he's now confident and he says, I want to represent myself. We just don't have a mechanism to require a defendant to participate in a state mental hospital competency evaluation under this case. And I don't think this court can adopt a test that somehow changes those legislative provisions to require that. And if you do, it will be very complex. So I think, again, if these cases mandated the adoption of some kind of test, that might be different. I don't think they do. And I think the test we have adequately protect defendants in these situations.
In fact, I just wonder, we don't have time, but if I understand your position, you're saying Edwards didn't add an extra hurdle. In this case, the inquiry ended at the waiver of the right to counsel. In other words, the trial court sort of took mental illness and competency issues into account in assessing whether the waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. My question for you is this: under Edwards, however, in a different case, let's say the court had gotten past that hurdle and concluded that it was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, are you suggesting that a trial court would not have discretion to preclude the defendant from proceeding to trial, per se, if it nonetheless had concerns that the defendant couldn't perform the basic tasks in his own defense?
I'll give you the lawyer answer, which is, it is unnecessary for a trial court to need to exercise that discretion, because the tests we have satisfy the constitutional requirements. They protect defendants who have mental health issues to ensure that if they waive their right to trial, that they can validly proceed, even if their defenses are bizarre, and even if their ability to operate is not that of a lawyer, which in some cases may be a good thing.
So I guess, in your view, then, if you get past the waiver, we're done. You're good to go.
Yes, I think that's right. And then I just want to mention that when you were in the early argument, of course, I was reading things and I was reading Edwards. And it's funny because it says this thing about trial courts may properly do this, but then it says that is to say, states may adopt a standard under Edwards that won't offend the Constitution. And so it doesn't, I'm not sure it clearly says it's bestowing discretion. I think it's saying, states may adopt such a test. I think in my position,
so Supreme Court can't come up with it, but we can.
My position is you should not do that. I'm not sure that you can because I'm not sure there's anything here that triggers a reason for this court to exercise either supervising power or due process in these cases. I have 29 seconds. I'm right on all the other issues. I'll turn it over to Ms. Nazar.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. In this case, Mr. Davis wanted to be the master of his own destiny and have personal control over his defense. He was dissatisfied with his counsel, as he explained to the court. He felt as if he was the only one fighting for himself. He stated, if I'm going to fight for myself, I'd rather fight. If I lose, I'd rather lose because of myself. The district court denied him his right to self-representation based on a misapplication of the law. Regardless of how this court interprets Indiana v. Edwards, Mr. Davis is entitled to a new trial based on this structural error. Prior to Indiana v. Edwards, the law was clear. Criminal defendants had a right to choose self-representation and personal autonomy under the Sixth Amendment in the Colorado Constitution. In order to exercise that right, the defendant needed to have two things. One, a defendant needed to have decisional competency, the competency to stand trial, under Dusky, and then make a valid waiver. Indiana v. Edwards would add a third layer if this court adopts that standard. For mentally ill defendants, they would then have to have a representational or functional competency to carry out the task. The findings that the court made here were not under Indiana v. Edwards. The Supreme Court had not issued the decision, and the court was not purporting to make any findings about Mr. Davis's ability to carry out his defense. What you have here is the district court misapplying the Gedina standard. Mr. Davis was competent to stand trial, so he was competent to make this waiver. There's no other competency at that level. And so the Court of Appeals reached the right result when they found that the district court had misapplied the law. However, I think the Court of Appeals was wrong to say that Indiana v. Edwards should apply for two reasons. Mr. Davis was not a gray area defendant because he did not suffer severe mental illness, and two, even assuming he suffered some degree of mental illness, it was not the type of mental illness that interfered with his cognitive ability to present a defense. Mr. Davis is very distinguishable from the defendant in Edwards, who has...
But would you explain to me what the structural error problem here is?
He was denied his right to self-representation under the Sixth Amendment. That's structural error. Automatic reversal.
And why is that? Aren't we looking at whether or not he was duly convicted in accordance with the law, and that the jury verdict probably is pretty sound? And you're basically asking for a new trial here when he's had. You know, the pudding doesn't taste right, is what I'm trying to say. I don't understand the structural error argument. Why it's automatic reversal when we can look at the record to say if he was fairly convicted or not by a jury.
Because the Sixth Amendment guarantees him his right to present his defense, and the Colorado Constitution guarantees him a right to appear and defend in person. And he was not allowed to present his defense. He was forced to have counsel who filed not a single motion on his behalf, who did not investigate the eyewitness to the crime, who did not make the arguments that he would have made. So he was not given his defense. He did not have his day in court. He had he's counseled stay in court. And under the circumstances here, that's structural error. You can't quantify what it meant for him to lose his right to express himself.
Ms. Nestor, can I ask a question? If we agree with that and we send it back to the trial court, what do we do on the remand? Do they have to redo the Arguello advisement if he gets a new trial? And then if he decides he wants counsel, he's had counsel? How do we untie that knot? Or is that not before?
Part of the reason why he wanted to go pro se was he was dissatisfied with Ms. Marvin's representation of him. I mean, he offered rational reasons for why he was dissatisfied with her. If he was given a new trial, I believe he'd have the opportunity to make the decision whether to move forward with counsel, or if he wanted to represent himself, then the court would have to do an Arguello advisement. He would need to be competent to stand trial and make a valid waiver, as he did here previously. But that would be his choice upon retrial, how to proceed, because he has equal rights to both proceed with the assistance of counsel or to proceed by himself.
All right, thank you.
I think the Attorney General is arguing that the district court's findings can be upheld because the district court found the Attorney General is trying to characterize the district court's findings as concerning the validity of the waiver. I think the record refutes that because the district court did use language concerning Mr. Davis's capacity and his capability, which are things that you focus on at the competency determination. Waiver determination looks at, did the court adequately advise the defendant of the dangers of going pro se? Did the defendant respond appropriately and lucidly that he understood it? If so, that's sufficient. I mean, the cases that the Attorney General rely on suggest that if the defendant is lucid and responsive during the advisement, the waiver would be valid. You really need a severe level of mental illness to invalidate a waiver.
Are you suggesting, though, that the trial court, in examining whether a knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver is being made, that they cannot take into account a defendant's mental capacity or mental illness?
I think mental illness is one factor among many that the court can consider, like the age, background, education, but it's not dispositive. The mental capacity, the ability for the defendant to understand the proceedings, that's competency. And he was found competent to stand trial, so he was competent to make his waiver under Godinez. Unless this court adopts Indiana v. Edwards, that's sufficient. The court should have allowed him to go pro se. I don't think the court gets to second guess his decision because the court thinks it's not in his best interest. I mean, his answers during our Arguello advisement were coherent, rational, and we even described him as articulate. After the second Arguello advisement, the court said, well, I don't think there's any question he understands the advisement. And that's the focus of the Arguello advisement, the waiver. Does he understand what he's doing? And he did understand. He asked for advisory counsel several times. He understood. He was asking the court to potentially allow him to make a worse offense than he would have with counsel. But that was his right.
Counsel, can I just get you to stop there for a moment? What I hear you arguing, and tell me why this is wrong, is essentially the position that Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas took in Edwards. I mean, they made very similar arguments to what you're or reasoning what you're making right now, and it seemed that the majority in Edwards said, no, it's okay. So I'm wondering if you can respond to that.
The majority said that state courts could decide to adopt this standard, as the Supreme Court in Indiana did, and the state in Indiana v. Edwards was arguing that this was an appropriate standard. Here, the state, in my case, is arguing that this court should not adopt Indiana v. Edwards, and that it's sufficient to have, you know, deem it, if you're competent to stand trial, and you're competent to make the waiver, and as long as the defendant makes a valid waiver, then he gets to go pro se. As far as I know, I mean, it's up to the Supreme Court to decide whether, as a policy matter, they want to adopt Indiana v. Edwards. As I said, at the time the district court made the findings here, there was no Indiana v. Edwards. There was no heightened standard in Colorado. So the court misapplied Godinez. New trial. If this court wants to adopt Indiana v. Edwards, I would still maintain that Mr. Davis had the capacity to carry out the task necessary to defend his defense. He raised objections when the court disallowed him from proceeding pro se. He said, I want to object. You're violating my constitutional rights. He argued points of law in his motions. He did not exhibit any disorganized speech or delusional ideations at any point when he was addressing the court.
I thought sometimes he just sat and stared. Didn't Judge Hoffman find that he would just be not responsive? He would just sit and stare sometimes when Judge Hoffman was talking to him, and also on occasion when the people down at the hospital were talking to him?
Yes, in 2006.
And that was one of the things that Judge Hoffman was concerned about, kind of fading in and out, if you will, of his attention and his ability to be reactive.
In 2006, when he was represented by Jason Pink, Mr. Pink called into question his competency because Mr. Pink was having a hard time cooperating with him. And I think it's undisputed he had a personality conflict with Mr. Pink. They did not get along. There were problems there. And the court expressly advised him that he had the right to not participate in the competency evaluations. So that is what he did. Three competency reports were done, and all three of them found him competent.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, though, but didn't some of them find him competent because lots of times those investigators or the psychologists will take the position that if you don't participate in a competency evaluation, you are, as a result, presumptively competent. So those aren't really very helpful, number one, but number two, I'm more concerned about his inability to react at all with Judge Hoffman. Sometimes he did, but sometimes he didn't. And who's to say which Mr. Davis is going to show up at trial?
The first two competency evaluations were very short, and they did just basically state that he didn't participate. And the second competency evaluation said, you know, it could be that this is a symptom of mental illness, his non-participation, or it could equally be that he is making a purposeful decision not to participate. The third competency evaluation was the most thorough, done by Dr. Fukutaki, and she actually looked at all his medical records and talked to, like, some guards at the jail, and talked to his counsel at the time, Ms. Martin, who was not having any problems with Mr. Davis in terms of communication, or she did not have any doubts as to his competency. Dr. Fukutaki specifically found there's no evidence available that he suffers from significant cognitive impairment or symptoms of mental illness. She found that his decision to not participate in evaluations was purposeful and willful. And so you do have one competency evaluation, Dr. Fukutaki's competency evaluation, that is pretty thorough. And you also have his counsel's opinion in 2007 saying, I mean, she believed that he was competent to knowingly waive his right to counsel. I think in 2006, Mr. Davis might have been in a different mental state, but by 2007, he is taking Wellbutrin, he's communicating with the court. I don't believe, he continued to request to go pro se throughout the beginning of trial, at sentencing. I mean, he was continuing this request. The non-communicative Mr. Davis, I think, was a function of his mental state in 2006 and his relationship with his counsel at the time.
Well, I understand that that's what you think, and I think a good case could be made for that, but that's not what Judge Hoffman thought. I mean, and he was the trial judge in charge. He was assessing all of this information, including what he was able to see right in front of him.
Right.
And part of what he was able to see right in front of him was the fact that this guy would sometimes be responsive and sometimes not.
But he was found competent to stand trial. And the medical professional said that there was no indication that he suffered from serious mental illness. So he was under Godinez, he had the competency to make the waiver. And the Arguello advisements, Judge Hoffman thought that the waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. That's what he says following the second Arguello advisement. He didn't have, there's no room if there's a Godinez test and Arguello advisement, there's no room for him to say, but I still want to withhold this right from him.
Could I ask something right there? So then, with regard to Edwards, then, when you say there's no room for him to do that, do you mean, well, let me ask it this way, are you just simply saying Edwards couldn't apply to your defendant because we were past that and we didn't have that as a standard and that's not what Judge Hoffman was considering? Or are you saying we should not, I guess we could call it adopt, or allow trial courts this additional room, that even if a defendant has made an effective waiver, that they still can deny him the right to proceed pro se?
If this court wants to adopt it, I don't think it's willy-nilly the court can withhold it from this defendant, and then this other district court is going to let someone with similar, you know, kind of indications of mental illness. That one gets to go pro se, and this one has to have counsel. I mean, there needs to be some kind of even application of the test, and at a minimum, it's the focus is, did the mental illness interfere with the defendant's ability to carry out the task necessary for a defense? And that's not what Judge Hoffman was finding. I mean, Judge Hoffman's findings are not that he couldn't carry out a defense. Judge Hoffman did not make findings as to his ability to carry out a defense. So they're not Indiana v. Edwards, and Indiana v. Edwards doesn't just allow district court's discretion to deny defendants their right to self-representation. It's more a question of, in certain circumstances, are some defendants so mentally ill that they cannot carry out the basic tasks necessary for their defense?
So I'm still not entirely clear. So you're just not taking a position on what we should do with regard to Indiana v. Edwards because you think it wouldn't cover
your
crime?
Well, I don't think it's necessary for this court to resolve the policy question of Indiana v. Edwards, to resolve what happened in Mr. Davis's case, because he didn't suffer from severe mental illness. There's nothing but Judge Hoffman's sort of instinct that, you know, in 2006, this guy stared at me and didn't communicate. But at that point, he had counsel who he hated. In 2007, he's on medication and he's telling the court, here are the reasons why I'm dissatisfied with Ms. Martin. Let me go pro se. And the court says, no, I don't think you're ready for that. I don't think this court has to get the Indiana v. Edwards to recognize in this case Mr. Davis was denied his right to self-representation. But if this court wants to get, I mean, this court has obviously taken several cases to decide this issue. I think it does in my brief. I addressed several problems with Indiana v. Edwards. And I think that this case sort of reflects the danger of just saying, well, now courts have discretion to withhold this right. There needs to be sort of criteria for when Indiana v. Edwards applies and who it applies to and how it's applied. And I think at the minimum, the district court needs to seek input from medical professionals as to whether defendants can carry out the tasks necessary to run their defense. Alternatively, I suggested that this court could require advisory counsel be appointed any time that there's a question of mental illness. And that would be a fair balancing of sort of everyone's interests.
So just, I guess, to summarize, I mean, it sounds like you are actually in agreement with the Attorney General that the existing tests for under Godinez, under Dusky, under Bison, under Arguello are all that's really necessary to protect the defendant's rights. In other words, to assure that the defendant is ready and able to proceed pro se. You're just disagreeing in this case that that waiver was valid right now.
I mean, in this case, the court found the waiver was valid, that he made a knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver, but the court said, he doesn't have the capacity. That was a competency finding that was in direct contradiction to Godinez, which one competency standard. So the district court misapplied the law here. That's why I don't think you need to reach Indiana v. Edwards. I don't know if I would say for every case of these two tests adequately. All I can answer for is for Mr. Davis, what the court did was misapplied to Venus. I would briefly address the second and third issues. I think the second issue is reflective of the larger problem with how Mr. Davis was treated by the court and his counsel. Neither the court nor his counsel were willing to listen to him or respect his wishes, even with regards to matters that should have been in his control. Because of their value judgments about his desires, they did not treat him as a free-thinking human, but rather hindered him in his ability to express himself and exercise his rights. It's undisputed that the decision to plead guilty belongs to the defendant, not his counsel. So the court appeals holding follows logically from this, that as a corollary, the decision to withdraw a guilty plea must also belong to the defendant. These decisions belong to the defendant because they're not strategic or tactical, but rather involve a waiver indication of the entire adversary process.
Ms. Nestor, can I ask you, was there ever a record made why counsel didn't pursue those? I guess that's my question. Was there ever a statement of, I don't plead with it?
No. I think that she thought it was not in his interest.
Was it that she didn't think it was in his best interest, or did she think that there wasn't a legal basis to withdraw the plea? That's what I'm asking. Was there...
She made no record as to that, as far as I know. Mr. Davis brought up the issue that she only visited him one time prior to trial. So my feeling would be that she didn't even investigate his claims that why he wanted to withdraw his plea.
Would there be a difference between someone, an attorney, saying that there's not a legal basis to withdraw the plea versus it's not in his best interest? Should we distinguish between the two?
I think because the decision belongs to the defendant, even if an attorney felt that there was not a strong legal basis, the attorney could still pursue it to the best of the attorney's ability.
But, I mean, I visualize it much like, you know, when an attorney knows that someone's going to take the stand and lie, they can't participate in that ethically. So they say, take the stand. Is there anything you want to tell the jury? Rather than participating in the fraud. Here, how would the attorney, that's what I'm asking, would there be something similar if it's a legal basis versus best interest? Do you see what I'm saying?
I think attorneys make arguments all the time that aren't very strong. I don't think that they're... I don't think that it's a matter of, you know, it's a different matter when a defendant's going to take the stand and...
Well, I mean, for example, if the attorney or if the defendant said, I pled guilty because someone held a gun to my head, and the attorney knows that that didn't happen, it was an open court, there's no way that that happened.
Uh-huh.
I mean, does the attorney then have the discretion to, how would the attorney handle that? It sort of puts them in sort of an ethical quandary, does it not?
Potentially, I mean, I don't think that the attorney could make an argument that the attorney knew it was false, but the attorney could say, you know, Mr. Davis would like to move to withdraw his pleas. He believes he was not adequately advised, and then make whatever record the attorney could make.
So back it down to where it's an ethically representative statement.
Correct.
Without pursuing the factual fraud.
Correct. I think it'd be possible for the attorney to pursue the client's objective in an ethical means, even if the attorney thought that there wasn't a strong legal basis.
Even if it bumped up against Rule 11? If there was not a Rule 11 basis for the argument to be made, what happens in that situation? Sort of a variation on what Justice Lewis was suggesting.
I mean, I think so one of the bases that Mr. Davis wanted to withdraw his plea is that he was arguing that he wasn't adequately advised. The attorney could say, Mr. Davis believes he wasn't adequately advised. Attorney rests on the record of, the providency hearing. That would still be respecting his wishes without making any kind of ethically incorrect arguments.
Okay, thank you.
And as to the last issue, I think the Court of Appeals created a slew of constitutional problems by creating a new appellate issue that differed from the proof at trial. And the prosecution's theory at trial was that there was one quantum of drugs. I do not think an appellate court gets to take a single sentence of testimony and say that from this sentence, the jury could have reached a different result that was different from the prosecution's theory below. And so we're going to affirm based on this speculative, newly concocted theory that was never presented to the jury. The United States Supreme Court has held on several occasions that an appellate court cannot affirm a conviction based on a new theory of the case, which was never presented to the jury. It offends the most basic notions of due process for there to be a variance between the court appeal's new theory of the case and the prosecution's theory and proof at trial. So this court does not vacate Mr. Davis's conviction based on the structural error of the denial of the right for self-representation. This court should vacate Mr. Davis's possession conviction based on Abby Odin. This court has no further questions.
Well, since you have a few minutes, I will ask a question. Okay. Let's return to the Feretta issue for a moment and just talk to me about, from your perspective, if we give judges some latitude to do what Judge Hoffman did here without embracing Indiana versus Edwards, or without accepting the invitation to create what you call the third layer, right? How much will real world implication do you think that has for Fredericks, right? Self-representation. How often do you think that's really going to become a problem where you're someone's right to self-representation?
I think if that comes to be a right as a terms of privilege for the intellectual elite, then it actually has to be respected. If district courts have discretion to deny the right to self-representation anytime they feel like it would be inconvenient, or they have a hunch that this is not an appropriate defendant to allow him the Sixth Amendment and Colorado constitutional right, then it's no right at all. Then it ceases to be a right. It's just a privilege for whoever the district court's deem.
The willy-nilly problem.
It will be a problem.
No, you talk about it being willy-nilly.
Yes, and I think, that's our thing. If the court wants to adopt Indiana v. Edwards, then it needs to articulate criteria for when who, what, how?
I would ask the court to reverse his convictions and we might have for a hearing on his motion to withdraw his plea.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I also want to thank you, Mr. Holman, Ms. Mosner, for your arguments. We are in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.